There's an old joke about a man who one day came across a tombstone, and on the tombstone was engraven these words, "Here lies a Christian intellectual." And the man muttered to himself, "Wow, the people around here must be awfully poor if they've had to bury two people in the same grave." And I guess that reflects a fairly common perception, doesn't it? That if you want to find rational thought and logical coherence and intellectual clarity, if you want to find reason, good, solid reason, then don't go looking for it amongst Christian believers. You won't find it there. Look for it amongst unbelievers, those whose minds haven't been befuddled and indoctrinated by the church. That's where you'll find proper reason. Don't look for it amongst Christians. It's a common perception that at the end of the day, Christianity and reason really don't mix. Well, this morning I want to challenge that perception, and I want to challenge it then on the basis of Acts chapter 17, verses 1 to 21. In these verses we have Paul having left Philippi in the circumstances that we considered 2 weeks ago. Here we have Paul preaching the gospel in three different locations, in Thessalonica, in Berea, and in Athens, kind of making his way around the western edge there of the Aegean Sea. And as he preaches the gospel then in these locations, we see two striking phenomena. We see reason flourishing as the gospel is accepted, and we see reason floundering as the gospel is rejected. And so I want us to look at those two themes, those two phenomena in turn. So first of all then, we see reason flourishing as the gospel is accepted. So the gospel then is accepted in this passage by some, at least in Thessalonica, and some in Berea. Of course, the gospel will also be accepted by some in Athens, but that lies in the next part of Acts 17, not the part that we're confining ourselves to this morning. And in both the Thessalonian acceptance of the gospel then, and the Berean acceptance of the gospel, the role of reason is emphasized by Luke. So first of all, in Thessalonica, reason is emphasized, for one thing, in connection with the preaching of Paul that generates this acceptance of the gospel. So we are told then in verses 2 and 3 that over three Sabbath days, Paul, having arrived in Thessalonica, goes into the Jewish synagogue and preaches there. And Luke uses three words to describe Paul's preaching. So verse 2, he reasoned with them. That's your first word, reasoned. In verse 3, explaining. That's your second word, explaining. And proving. That's your third word, proving. And so it's clear, isn't it, from those three words, what sort of preaching Paul is engaging in here. This is carefully argued, content-heavy, mind-engaging preaching that Paul is delivering in that Thessalonian synagogue. So it's emphasized in connection with the preaching that generates the acceptance of the gospel, but reason is also emphasized in connection with this acceptance of the gospel itself in Thessalonica. How is this acceptance of the gospel described? An interesting phrase, verse 4, some of them were persuaded. That's the word Luke uses. Some of them were persuaded. It suggests then that they listened to Paul and they analyzed arguments and they weighed up what was being presented to them and they applied themselves mentally to Paul's message and they concluded that it was convincing and it was compelling. And so you can see then the role of reason clearly emphasized in Thessalonica. But then we move on to Berea. And in Berea, we're not told much about Paul's preaching. And I suppose when it comes to the Bereans' acceptance of the gospel, we could casually read verse 12, many of them believed, and think that there's no emphasis here on reason. I mean, believing, that's just an act of the will, isn't it? It's not an act of the minds. People just decide to believe all sorts of things that they've never subjected to any kind of intellectual scrutiny. But when you read verse 12 carefully, there's a word I missed out just now. Luke doesn't say many of them believed. He says many of them therefore believed. To what does the therefore relate? Well, it relates back to the previous verse, where we're told that these Bereans, as they listened to Paul, they were examining the scriptures. And that's a strong word. Luke uses that word a lot. It's one of his favorite words. But in every other instance, he uses it in a legal context. So we have Pilate examining Jesus in Luke 23:14. We have the Sanhedrin examining Peter and John in Acts 4:9. We have Herod examining the guards under whose watch Peter has escaped from prison, Acts 12:19. We have Felix examining Paul, Acts 24:8. We have the Roman authorities generally examining Paul in Acts 28:18. And it's the same word that he uses here of the Bereans examining the scriptures. So in other words, for the Bereans, then the issue is not whether or not we like what Paul is saying. The issue is not whether or not what Paul is saying scratches where we are itching. No, for the Bereans, the issue is it true? Is it tenable? Is it credible? And they take the text that Paul is throwing at them, and they put those texts in the dock, and they examine them, they probe them, they interrogate them. They give them a hard time until they are absolutely satisfied that what Paul is saying corresponds to what those texts are saying. And it's on the basis then of that intellectual scrutiny that they believed in verse 12. That's the significance of the therefore. Therefore, having examined, having probed, having prodded, having scrutinized, therefore they believed. So just like their counterparts in Thessalonica, these Bereans have been persuaded, in other words. So I'm saying then that in both the Thessalonian acceptance of the gospel and the Berean acceptance of the gospel, the role of reason is emphasized, the importance of the mind. And we today should be targeting people's minds. Evangelism is about persuading people. Now, I know that statement needs to be qualified in certain ways. I'm not saying that by ourselves we can persuade anybody into becoming a Christian. There has to be that inner renewal by the Holy Spirit. I'm not saying that persuasion is the only human factor in a conversion. There's our transformed lives and the testimony, the witness of those. They can make a deep impression on people. Think of Peter's words in 1 Peter 3 about unbelieving husbands being won without a word by the conduct of their wives. I'm not saying that we should approach evangelistic conversations on doorsteps or wherever in a highly combative fashion, with a heavily stocked arsenal of arguments that we intend to blast at the people we're talking to. I'm not saying that evangelistic conversations will look exactly the same, irrespective of whether they're taking place among students in an Oxford college or amongst pensioners at Fallen End shops. I'm not saying any of those things. But what I am saying is that the appeal in evangelism is not to the emotions, whether that be through manipulative altar calls set against a backdrop of haunting, soulful musical accompaniment, whether it be moving people to tears with graphic scenes from Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ, whether it be inviting shoppers on Northumberland Street with all their aches and pains and afflictions to come and sit on a special healing chair. No, the appeal in evangelism is not to the emotions, nor is the appeal in evangelism directly to the will even, not in the first instance. Kind of urging a decision on people, a profession of faith, a sinner's prayer, when they don't really know what it is that they are making a decision about. No, the appeal in evangelism is to the mind. We persuade people. We address them at a rational level, stating truths, explaining terms, answering questions. We engage their mental faculties. That's what's involved in biblical evangelism. And so I'm saying that's the first phenomenon that we encounter in our passage this morning. We see reason flourishing as the gospel is accepted. But then notice, secondly, we see reason floundering as the gospel is rejected. We see reason floundering as the gospel is rejected. So the gospel is rejected in our passage by two groups of people. It's rejected by the Jews of Thessalonica, not all of them, but some of the Jews of Thessalonica, and by the Greeks of Athens. And in both cases then, the absence of reason is emphasized. If the role of reason has been emphasized where the gospel has been accepted, here now, as the gospel is rejected, the absence of reason is emphasized. At worst, this rejection that we see in our passage is mindlessly uncivilized, and at best, it is comically self-contradictory. So notice first then the Jews of Thessalonica and their rejection of the gospel. We've already noticed one kind of vocabulary in our passage, haven't we? Words like reason, explaining, proving, persuaded, examining. There's that strand of words in our passage. But there's another kind of vocabulary that we encounter here also. A vocabulary associated with these gospel-rejecting Jews of Thessalonica. Words like jealous, verse 5. Formed a mob, verse 5. Three words in the English, but it's just one word in the Greek. Set in an uproar, verse 5. Again, four words in the English, one word in the Greek. Dragged, verse 6. What they did to this man Jason, presumably he's one of the converts in Thessalonica, and just like Lydia and the jailer in Philippi, this man, having been converted, has opened his house to the Christians. Paul and his team and perhaps other Christians already starting to meet there also, and unable to find Paul and his companions, who they're really after, they drag Jason out. Shouting, verse 6. Agitating, verse 13. Stirring up, verse 13 again. I mean, this is about as far removed from the language of reason as you can get. This vocabulary creates a picture of these people charging about like wild animals, driven by sheer angry passion, by sheer gut impulses, rather than by any coherent rational arguments. So there's that aspect, the kind of mindlessly uncivilized. But there's another aspect also to this rejection in Thessalonica, where we move from the mindlessly uncivilized to the comically self-contradictory. I'm referring to these charges that they bring against Paul and his companions in verses 6 and 7. And you'll notice then that the main charge really is that Paul and his companions are being lawless. That's the main charge against them. They've turned the world upside down. The NIV has that better. They've caused trouble all over the world. That's a better translation. They're troublemakers. That's the accusation. Or then again, verse 7, they are acting against the decrees of Caesar. Again, they're troublemakers. They're lawless. They don't abide by law and order. That's what they're being accused of. But of course, the funny thing is here are these men accusing Paul and his companions of being lawless. What are they doing? Well, they're in the streets gathering all the rogues and the scoundrels and creating a mob and charging about the place in a completely lawless and disorderly fashion, causing unrest. In fact, we're told in verse 5 about them attacking the house of Jason. That's a very strong word Luke uses. They attacked the house. It was basically an act of vandalism. These men accusing Paul and his companions of being lawless, and they're going around attacking people's houses. They're the ones being lawless, not Paul and his companions. But reason is so absent from them that they just can't see the self-contradictoriness of it all. But if the main charge is the charge of lawlessness, there's actually a subordinate charge as well. There in verse 6, it's mentioned that they have come here also. Paul and his companions, they've been causing trouble all over the world, and they've come here also. In other words, it's a mark of how dangerously fanatical these men are that they can't just stay in one location, they have to travel from place to place. But the funny thing is, what do we see these very people doing? We see them travelling to Berea next, don't we? And following Paul and his companions there. They're travelling from place to place in just the same way that they've been accusing Paul and his companions of travelling from place to place. They're just as dangerously fanatical as Paul and his companions are. But again, reason is so absent from them, they just can't see it. So that's the Jews of Thessalonica and their rejection. What about the Greeks of Athens? Well, in their rejection of the gospel, we see none of the kind of mindlessly uncivilized. We don't see them causing a riot on the streets. But we do see more of this comical self-contradictoriness that I've been talking about. Luke uses two key terms in connection with these people in Athens. One is the noun philosophers, there in verse 18. This is a city of philosophers. The word, of course, literally means lover of wisdom. And this city of Athens, then, it's just full of lovers of wisdom. And then the other key term Luke uses is the verb to know. So verse 19, as they bring Paul to the Areopagus, they say, "May we know." And then again, verse 20, "We wish to know." And so these people in Athens, they are hungry for knowledge. They are really into wisdom and knowledge. And it's this love of wisdom and this hunger for knowledge then that drives their rejection of the gospel. It's such a condescending question they ask there of Paul, isn't it, in verse 18. What does this babbler wish to say? It's pure intellectual snobbery. You can imagine them rolling their eyes and shaking their heads every time Paul uses a split infinitive or ends a sentence with a preposition or slips in a double negative or whatever the other shibboleths were in Athenian intellectual circles. You can imagine the pained expressions on their faces that their refined ears should have to be exposed to such unrefined speech. You can imagine the sarcastic comments, "Well, this Paul, he's not exactly Socrates, is he?" You can imagine the disdain flowing through every syllable of that sentence. What does this babbler wish to say? I'm saying it was their love of wisdom and their hunger for knowledge that was driving their rejection of the gospel. But this is the thing. Notice Luke tells us two other things about these Athenians, which paint a rather different picture. Number one, their addiction to idolatry. Verse 16, the city was full of idols. It's a striking word that Luke uses there. It seems to convey the idea of the city kind of being loaded under the weight of idols, kind of swamped, if you like, or submerged by idols. It was that flooded with them. just everywhere there were idols. And you see the irony then. Here are these people, and they're so committed to reason that they can't possibly listen to this uncouth babbler, Paul. And yet they're so devoid of reason that they worship obsessively a multitude of painted statues that can't talk and can't move and can't show any signs of life whatsoever. Their addiction to idolatry. And then the other thing Luke tells us is their addiction to novelty. And this is verse 21. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. And Luke, you can kind of feel the sarcasm now in Luke's pen, can't you? Presumably they can't just have done nothing else, but that's how Luke presents it. It's like the child, and he nags at his parents all summer for a new Newcastle United top. And his parents say, well, you've already got a Newcastle United top, and it's only a year old, and it fits you perfectly well. But no, that's no good, because there's a new top out now. And okay, it still has black and white stripes, just like the last one, and same badge, and the same sponsor written across the front, but it's different, it's new, and so you have to have the new one. And these Athenians are that infantile when it comes to ideas and philosophies. And again, you see the irony then. They're so committed to reason, they can't possibly listen to this uncouth babbler, Paul. But they're so devoid of reason, they can't resist the pull of the recent, the contemporary, the up-to-date. And so, whether it's the mindlessly uncivilized or the comically self-contradictory, we see then this phenomenon, reason floundering as the gospel is rejected. And it strikes me then that that pretty much describes what we see in our society today. Reason floundering as the gospel is being so widely rejected. Perhaps this morning you're someone who finds that a very surprising statement. Perhaps you're the kind of person who, stumbling across a tombstone with the words, "Here lies a Christian intellectual," would jump to the same conclusion as the man in the joke. Well, this isn't the time or the place to engage in a lengthy treatment of this matter, but let me this morning just leave you with this, with two worldviews. So on the one hand then, we have the dominant worldview of our society today, a worldview that says everything is the product of total disorder, blind forces operating randomly, but which celebrates the beauty and logic of Mozart's music and Shakespeare's sonnets and Einstein's equations. A worldview which says that human existence is utterly insignificant. We are just a tiny blip within a huge empty universe that will one day drive us to extinction. But which treats as earth-shatteringly important all sorts of things every day, from Ken Livingstone's opinions to Leicester City's bid for the Premier League title to the weather forecast for Bank Holiday Monday. A worldview which says that we humans are purely physical beings and there's nothing more to us than cells and atoms and molecules. But which waxes lyrical at funerals about angels and heaven and being in the room next door. A worldview which says there is no objective right and wrong, but which celebrates the triumph of justice for the victims of the Hillsborough disaster. That's one worldview. On the one hand, we have that. And then on the other hand, we have the Christian worldview, which says that there is a God who made everything. And that's why there's beauty and logic in Mozart's music and Shakespeare's sonnets and Einstein's equations. A worldview which says that human beings are highly significant, made in the image of the Creator for his enjoyment. And that's why we see significance in the details of daily life. A worldview which says we are more than just matter, and death is not the end. A worldview which says that there is objective right and wrong, a law which God has written, and which we have all broken. And to atone for the breaking of which God has sent his Son into this world to die on a cross. That's the other worldview. And I don't want to engage in a lengthy argument this morning, but just leave you with this question then. I want you to face this question openly and without prejudice this morning. In which of those worldviews is reason flourishing? And in which of those worldviews is reason floundering? Forget what you've read in The Guardian. Forget what you've seen on Channel 4 documentaries. Just approach that question open-mindedly this morning. In which of those worldviews is reason floundering? And in which of those two worldviews is reason flourishing? Amen.